So tonight's Dharma talk, I called the three modes of practice. This comes from the following thought, I suppose. Often when we think of Dharma practice, we think about sitting practice. That's what's important. It's a sitting practice. And I guess what I want to say is that's a dangerous and narrow view of what this practice is all about. In both the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, and in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on loving kindness practice, he says that we should practice walking, standing, seated, or lying down. Exactly the same phrasing in both of those suttas, the two main suttas on actual meditation practice. Well, if you think about what that says, walking, standing, seated, lying down, this is code. This is Buddhist code for practice all the time. Because, I mean, when are you not doing one of those four things? In fact, in one of the two places it says, or any other position you happen to find yourself, just to be really precise, just in case, So the question then arises, how can we possibly do this? I remember those instructions were given to monastics who the vast majority of their time was spent in actual doing formal practice. That was the theory anyway. But we're householders, we live in the world. So I want to put forward the idea that we can't separate our practice, our formal seated practice, from the rest of our daily life. We can't say, well, I practice and then I do this other stuff. It's just not enough to say, well, I'm going to do my half hour or 40 minutes or however long your regular daily sitting practice is. And it's not what the Buddha intended. So how can we find a balance between living our life in the world, because we're householders and that's what we do, doing that mindfully, having a daily practice, a regular daily practice, and the third mode, finding time for retreat, to go for more extended periods of practice. And these three modes are living in the world, daily practice, and retreat practice, complement and intertwine with each other and feed each other quite nicely. And so what I want to do is look at these three modes more carefully and see how we can actually do them. The first one is like, how can we be mindful in the world? Well, we can't realistically be actually spending our day as we go about our day shopping and working and doing all the stuff we do, doing mindfulness practice, noting each breath as it arises and it falls. And it just is not practical. For one thing, this is quite interesting, that a formal concentrated seated practice is working from one part of the brain and actually operating in the world, like driving a car and doing all the stuff we do, uses a totally different part of the brain. So we have to understand that we can't just, unless we're monastics and we're going to go into permanent retreat for the rest of our lives, we can't just be practicing mindfulness all day long. But we can be mindful all day long. That's, and I'm making a distinction here. And there are several ideas, several ways we can do this. One is an idea I've taken and talked about many times, from Thich Nhat Hanh, where Thich Nhat Hanh basically says, just imagine the following. You're in your car, or maybe you're on your bike, or maybe you're in a bus for that matter, or whatever. You're in motion on the streets of the world, and you come to a red light and you have to stop. Often our reaction to that red light is a sense of mild frustration. Oh, I'm stopped by this red light. And that frustration arises because often when we're out in the world moving in that way, our mind is already at the destination, figuring out, well, I got to go to that part of the store, and then I got to go to that store afterwards, and we're out there doing something as opposed to being in our car heading there or in our mode of transportation. Our mind isn't in the present moment at all. And so what Thich Nhat Hanh says is, oh, instead, turn that red light into, oh, look, what a great opportunity to practice. I can't go anywhere. I might not want to close my eyes because I'll miss when the light changes, but I can even practice with my, and just, even if I just pay attention to 3 breaths or 5 breaths, now I've turned that red light into not a problem, an annoyance, but an opportunity to actually do just this brief little. It's not to be like, I'm not going to sit at the red light for half an hour and do a formal sitting practice, but I can practice for 5 breaths. Real easy to do. Just 5 breaths. Or however many you can fit in, that depends how long the red light is, I suppose, right? And this takes us back to, in our busy daily zooming around life, to an awareness of what's arising right in that moment. It allows us to stop the busyness, even if it's just for 5 breaths, right? And here's the interesting thing. This doesn't have to be a red light. It could be, depending on your life and your druthers, I suppose, you can use anything that reoccurs in your life to be something that reminds you to come back to the present. That's a cue, in a sense. So every time you walk through a doorway, every time you get in or out of your car, every time you put something in your mouth, these can all be moments where we consciously choose to stop and go, and just take, maybe, sometimes it's only 1 breath. Maybe it's like 3 breaths, 5 breaths, who knows? But it's a cue that says, I don't have to just continue to zoom all the time. I can just stop and go back into this state of awareness. I've done some teaching at the local hospital where I'm a volunteer chaplain, and I encourage the staff to use the cue just before I walk into a patient's room. That's when I want to stop and just pay attention to the breath for just 2 or 3 breaths. Just be that little bit of mindfulness and see how that shifts how they feel as they walk into that room. They're not hurrying into the room. They're grounded as they walk into the room. I suspect it makes a significant difference to the people in the room for someone to come in with that energy. And so these little reminders, and you're thinking, walking through a doorway. Well, we might do that 20 times a day. So that's 20 times we're reminded to be mindful. That's a significant difference from our normal mode of operation, which is just moving along. And oh, yeah, I'll be mindful when I sit later on. Or I was mindful when I was sitting. Now I'm living my life. We're sort of blending these two things together so that we're consciously choosing to be mindful. another way that this practice in the world can be quite useful is when we find ourselves, for whatever reason, it might be a physical crisis or an emotional crisis or any some kind of crisis, but we find ourselves in one of those situations like, oh my God, your mind is going, what the heck am I going to do now? Or, oh my God, look what that other person is doing. And we get wound. This is a perfect time to slow down. And it's also a perfect time to practice. And this might mean, consciously like pausing, consciously getting out of the mind, which is often where that crisis is in the mental process, and drop down into the body. And just tune into where the body is right now and go, just be aware. And maybe you take a whole minute. Radical idea in a busy day would take a whole minute, but just to sort of tune in to what's going on. And even you can ask a question because you're in sort of in turmoil, perhaps. Just you can drop this little question into the mind, something like along the line, what's going on? Not expecting some long discursive answer or not in the sense of trying to figure it out, but just by pausing, dropping into the body and dropping that question into the mind, and then just sitting still, sometimes something meaningful arises in the mind, like, oh, here I am again, caught in this same old story, perhaps. Or here I am again, reacting to that person who always gets me to react this way. We have little moments of insight if we pause in those moments. And often this little pause is the difference between just reacting and creating more suffering for ourselves and more suffering for others and not. It's often the difference between making a difficult experience more difficult, more painful, and not. Just because we consciously chose to use the practice we already know, we all know what the practice of mindfulness is, of paying attention to the body sensation and the breath. This sort of, meditation 101, right? This is why, by the way, the Buddha put so much attention to mindfulness of the body in his meditation instructions, why it came first. So that when we are in our daily lives, we have this practiced capability to tune into the body. And that allows us to be okay or more okay with what's actually happening. There's another thing we can do, and that is practice the precepts. Precepts, the five precepts, which are something that we talk a lot about. And I'm sure some of you've all heard this, the guidelines for leading a virtuous life, for practicing what's called sila. This is practice, because these are difficult things to do sometimes. So precepts of non-harming, taking only what is offered, mindful speech, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and refraining from the abuse of alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind. These our practices, there's things we have to consciously choose to do, understanding that sometimes we're not going to be that successful, that sometimes we're going to not quite meet the ideal, and be okay with that, not beat ourselves up about that, but consciously reminding ourselves in all the situations that we encounter during the day that we want to come from that place of virtue in our interactions with others. Here's the interesting thing. Those five precepts are actually the beginning of the list. Those are the five precepts that all beginning monastics take and where everybody takes when they go on retreat. The next three, however, are usually only talked about in the context of retreat, but I think have quite clear value in our daily busy life. And so I want to talk briefly about these three. And so in terms of the monastic tradition, the next three are to refrain from eating at the forbidden time, to refrain from dancing, singing, music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, using perfumes, and beautifying the body with cosmetics. And number eight, refrain from lying on a high and luxurious sleeping place. Now, those are monastic versions of these things, right? But they all, I think, have great value when we look at them from the context of our normal daily lives. They all have to do with renunciation. And in the strict monastic sense, these are quite severe. For many people, the idea of giving up all these things would be difficult. But on retreat, not eating at the forbidden time sometimes means not eating afternoon. Like you eat the noon meal and then you don't eat until the next day. Some retreats have this as a rule. Some retreats have this as an option, where you can choose to add in these next three precepts besides the first five. But in our daily life, this means just being careful not to eat too much, not to eat more than we need, not to be careful what we eat and to eat only what's healthy. Because eating too much, eating unhealthy food, these are all ways that take away our energy that could be used instead in practice. If we're really super full because we stuffed ourselves, it's really hard to be mindful afterwards because we're just like falling asleep. It doesn't work. The second of these, this list of things we should refrain from, dancing, singing, music, da 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 da, big long list, it points to two habits in our culture. To entertain ourselves when we're bored. Oh God, I'm really bored. I got to find something to distract myself. And that's what we use these things for. And by the way, I'm not saying that any of these things are bad. I'm just saying that if we're not careful, they turn into ways we successfully distract ourselves from actually paying attention. I love to dance. I don't sing, I love to chant, for instance. But our culture encourages us to do this all the time. If you're bored, do something that isn't boring to get yourself going. As opposed to going, oh, I'm bored, or I think I'm bored. Maybe I'm just not paying enough attention. So one of my teachers actually said that to me on my first long retreat, about halfway through, so about 2 weeks in, I've been practicing following the rules. And I went into an interview and I said, God, this practice is really boring. I mean, I said exactly those words. And he just sort of smiled at me and he said, you're just not paying enough attention. And he was right. When I started, because I took that, I said, okay, what does he mean? And I took that and I started really paying attention to things more, and the boredom just went away. The idea of the boredom just went away. And then there's this whole thing of beautifying ourselves, talking about the body with cosmetics and things, making ourselves beautiful. This is a real trap in our culture about how we have to always look our best and look good, and what's wrong with you for not wanting to sort of, go shopping and get more clothes and da 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 da. It's so easy to fall into that as opposed to looking at those sorts of things as well. I have to have clothes because I can't sort of live in this climate without clothes. I can't live in this world without clothes. I mean, it's not, have to sort of, put some clothes on when I go out into the world. But make that sort of functional and utilitarian. Just like, these are things I need. Yeah, I have to have these things. I'm going to get, and maybe, get good quality things or things with a certain style that I like, but not to sort of go overboard. And then this last thing, which is as I said, it's like not having a high or luxurious bed. Well, this is more in our daily regular lives, not our monastic lives. I mean, if you've ever been on retreat, the beds aren't high and luxurious, I'll tell you, any place I've been on retreat anyway. But it's like our culture, once again, teaches us that it's best if we have lots of really cool stuff that's maybe even luxurious, like the latest cell phone model with the latest doodads and widgets on it, or the latest this or the latest that or the coolest this or whatever. The problem with all these things, and this is once again our culture tells us we need these things to be cool, to be hot, to be sexy, to be whatever, to be special. The problem is to get those things, to obtain those things, we have to have money that we have to earn and then spend to get these things. And all that time we spend earning that money, we could spend practicing instead. It's like, this is like, a lot of economists would shoot me for saying this, but we don't really need a lot of that stuff. We don't need to maintain the economy by buying more stuff all the time. Especially when they're not of simple utility, which is a lot of stuff that we tend to get if we're not careful. So these three additional ones are just an addition to the five traditional precepts. These are all things. These are like simple things that are practices. Doesn't mean you have to be perfect. Doesn't mean you have to never dance and sing, but you have to choose, because sometimes dancing and singing, if you're chanting with other people, for instance, it can be very uplifting and powerful. As opposed to say singing your favorite AC/DC tunes or something like that. It's just a different kind of singing. And we can choose and understand what's going on. And then, within the limits of our lives, and also within the limits of sociability, I mean, sometimes it's kind of nice to go out to watch a movie. Not that we've been able to do that lately, but I mean, you know what I mean. And so there's this balance in our lives that we have to find where that's not our main way of acting in the world. It's something that we do, but not that we live by, I guess that would be a good way to do it. So the final thing, way we can take this practice into the world is to carefully choose who you hang out with and how much energy you put into socializing. This is another way that we can very quickly get caught up in an energy drain of just, the old friends of mine, I should go spend some time with these old friends of mine. And it's not necessarily always a good idea in terms of if I'm going to make practice my main emphasis in life, which is I'm encouraging you to think of. It's dangerous in a sense to be highly social. I want to read a little poem here. This is from Naomi Shihab Nye. And it's one of my favorite poems in a way, because it has a tongue firmly planted in cheek, but it talks about what I've just been talking about. It's called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" Say no. When they invite you to a party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, we should get together, say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know that you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. It's a big Dharma poem as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if she would think that, but. Second of these modes of practice, and that's a daily sitting practice. I can't emphasize this enough. It's so easy to fall into the mode of, oh, I'll practice when I feel like it, or when I'm feeling happy, or when I'm in a better mood. It's practicing when you're not in a good mood is probably more valuable, for one thing. It makes you more aware of that. But mainly, daily practice is a discipline. You make a personal commitment just to yourself, to regular practice. As one of my teachers said, you have to make sure you get your tush on the cush every day. And sometimes he said, sometimes when it's real busy, you only get 5 minutes. That's better that than not, oh, well, I don't have half an hour, so I'm not going to practice today. Find the time. The benefits of practice are cumulative. So the more you practice, the more regularly you practice, the deeper you go. It's really a straight line equation. I'm speaking from personal experience here. Continuity of practice is the key part of this. This deepening of the practice. It's like the more we have this continuous thing of practicing every day and every day and every day, it becomes like not practicing feels weird. It's like my whole day got kind of weird because I didn't practice this morning. And it's important, if you can, to always practice at the same time, have a regular time, and sit in the same place. It's like the mind sort of knows, oh, it's that time of day. Oh, I'm in that spot. The mind goes, oh, it must be time to be quiet. The mind works in that way. Best time is early in the morning because no one else is doing anything and there's not a lot of stuff going on out there. Or in the evening around sunset. Those are traditionally the two times when it's favored just to practice. And this sitting in the same place, it doesn't have to be like, you know, oh, I have to set up a separate room in my house just for meditation. But it might be as simple as there's this corner in the one room I live in where normally what I do there is I sit and practice. And I try not to use that space for anything else. So that there's sort of an energy that builds up in that space. I don't know if you've ever been in like a really, really old temple or a really, really old cathedral, you know, where people have been practicing for hundreds or sometimes thousands of years. There's an energy in those places because that's what's been going on there for that huge amount of time. And the energy literally builds in that space. And that's what we do with our sitting space. So always try and sit in the same spot and at the same time. It's also important, however, that you don't get discouraged and beat yourself up if you miss. I mean, stuff happens. We live in the world. We're householders, right? You know, we have to go someplace at the time we normally sit. We're going to be sitting on the bus going to the airport instead. Well, I'm probably not going to sit in my favorite spot and practice. Though I have tried to actually do sitting practice on a shuttle bus going to the airport. It was not wildly successful, but it was interesting to sort of see what that was like. So if you miss a day, it's not like, oh, well, I missed a day, that's it. I'm not going to do my regular practice anymore. It's like, okay, time to start again. One teacher I know says that basically this whole of this practice of having a daily practice is starting again over and over and over. Starting again and starting again and starting again. Because that's the reality of life. You know, and also it's like, because we're holders, maybe we have to, you know, take care of an ill family member or help a neighbor who's not doing well. I mean, there's lots of stuff in our lives that get in the way of that regular daily practice. And so we have to accept that too. But as much as possible, we want to keep that regular daily practice all the time. I'm one of these disgusting morning people. I get up early. I like to practice early in the morning before my day gets going. Because once it gets going, you know, there's stuff happening and you're dealing with people on the phone and all that stuff, you know, it just gets harder to actually sit down again. And so now we come to the third mode of practice. This is retreat practice. I think retreat practice is essential. Number one, absolutely essential that we actually find time for retreat practice. The Buddha, in many, many places in the sutta, the Buddha talks about the importance of being in seclusion, which is really what a retreat practice is. You know, it's like we seclude ourselves from our daily lives. We seclude ourselves from all of the things we normally do to distract ourselves. You know, so in a traditional Theravadin retreat, we're practicing noble silence. We're not talking. We're also not reading or writing. In stricter retreats, we're not even making eye contact with other people. It's very sort of all the things that you would normally be using to distract ourselves when we get bored. They're all gone. None of them are relevant or even there anymore. So now we have to just pay attention to what's actually happening right now. That's all there is to do. Literally, all there is to do is see what's arising in the mind and work with it. This is where we start to go deeper, where we start to go more inner in the practice, where we learn to concentrate more, where deep intuitive insights arise. Almost exclusively for me, those big insights into practice have all arisen on retreat. So it's at the same time, I understand that this whole idea of going on retreat, like separating yourself from your daily life completely, might seem kind of like odd. But, and it might also seem like, but that might be really difficult. These days, because we haven't been able to actually go and retreat physically in the same place, it's more difficult. I'll acknowledge that right now. You know, I've been teaching day longs, and it's nice to be together with people in this zoomy way for a day, but it's not the same as being all together in the same space. There's a certain energy of practice that comes from retreat. You know, you might think, oh God, this is just going to be so difficult. But then you're with all these other people who are on retreat, who are practicing intensely, and that just rubs off. You get into this, oh, if they can do this, I can do this energy. That just sort of, it feeds. And that doesn't matter if it's for a day or a weekend or a week or a month or longer. Retreat's a retreat. And this is when we start to really see deeply into the nature of the mind and start to have a deeper understanding of things like unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self. The three things that we have to actually figure out on a insightful, intuitive level as we go deeper into the practice. So some of you may be thinking, as I have from time to time, yeah, but I can't go on retreat. I'm too busy. I'm too old. I'm not well enough. I have too many responsibilities in the world. I have kids. I have aging parents. I mean, you know, the list of things we can use as excuses to not go on retreat is endless. Understand that. You'll come up with 1,000 reasons you shouldn't go on retreat if you let yourself. But now I want you to imagine the following. You get up in the morning. You don't turn on your computer or your TV, and you keep your turn your cell phone off if it's been on, and you sit. Just like your normal daily sit. But then, maybe like me, you have a cup of coffee first, actually. But and then after that, you eat a simple breakfast in silence. And then you go for a brisk walk outside. Walk around the neighborhood. That doesn't have to be a big hike. Just like a 20-minute, half-hour walk around the neighborhood. We all have routes we take when we go for walks around the neighborhood. It's one thing about this COVID thing is we've really learned to get our neighborhoods in our minds and know where all the great places to walk are. Then after you get back from the walk, you sit again. Second sit of the day. Then you go outside, or maybe you stay inside and you do some formal walking practice, you know, where you walk back and forth in a line, maybe 20 minutes of walking practice. And then you sit for a third sit. You've just been on retreat. That's what a retreat is. And it might just be half a day. It might be, this might, the whole thing might have been three and a half hours. But this is a retreat. Because you've made practice the focal point, and it's become a continuous flow of practice over a longer period of time. That's all a retreat is. Just some retreats, that period of time is longer. That's all. But anyone can find time to take a morning, take a Sunday morning off, turn off all our devices, and practice. This is available to anyone. And sure, this might take a little coordination with family members or people you live with. You know, maybe you got to get someone to walk the dog for you or whatever. But it isn't that difficult. And it's just we have to consciously choose to do it. So here's these three modes of practice, right? In daily life, our regular practice on the cushion every day, and retreat practice. These three weave together over a longer period of time. They are very strongly interrelated to each other. They mutually support. When I've done a long retreat, and then I come and start doing my daily sitting, boy, daily sitting is like, oh, this is great. It just really changes the flavor of daily sitting after you've been on a retreat. Because you have this sort of built up energy of the intensity of practice. And similarly to my daily life, when I've been on a long retreat and I come back, it's like I really tune into things a lot more. I'm much more mindful of what's going on in the world. And even if I have that, even like for daily sitting sort of encourages me to want more in a sense. Oh, that was great, but really I'd like to do something more. Encourages us to go on retreat, but it also helps us keep our daily life together. I really found that my daily practice has really helped me deal with all the stuff that's been arising in my mind about living in this secluded pandemic world. It just makes, I'm so glad I have a daily practice that helps me keep that together. And there's two reasons I think this is so important, these three modes of practice. Number one, practice is the vehicle, in a sense, that takes us to this place of true happiness, not based on having things, actual happiness. I mean, the Buddha was called the happy one for a reason. It's like, without practice, this is just like this interesting theoretical idea about how you might sort of live your life. But practice is what allows us to actually put it into action and experience the results of that practice. The Buddha was always telling people, no, don't just listen to me, practice. And then experience what happens when you practice. There's a poem. This is from a book of poems by Hafiz. For those of you who aren't familiar with Hafiz, he's like a contemporary of Rumi, but less well known than Rumi in terms of his poetry. This one's called "I Got Kin." Plant so that your heart will grow. Love, so God will think, ah, I got kin in that body. I just started inviting that soul over for coffee and rolls. Sing, because this is a food our starving world needs. Laugh, because that is the purest sound. So that's living in the world. Practice. Singing and laughing. Two really good things. So that's one reason I think things are important. But even more important is that I think having our life become practice, which is really what I'm talking about here. If all of our life is pointed towards practicing more often, being more conscious, living in the world, this is the only way I can see from, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, the only way I can see where I can make change in the world is by changing myself. If I can change myself, that energy that I create by changing myself goes out into the world and changes the world. And that's what's really important. And these days, probably even more important. So I'm going to read one more poem here. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In, and it's called The Fruits of Practice, which talks about this idea I've been talking about. Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality doesn't quite line up with what I'd choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that is what life holds. Practice hasn't brought an end to pain. I still increase my suffering like a fish caught on the line. My struggle only draws the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox. The courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No, practice hasn't brought an end to pain, but it has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, much less predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is my way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey unfolding in this very moment. It's the journey that reveals the truth and not the destination. So practice, practice, practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.